You're listening to Green Left Radio. For our program today, we are pleased to have Sam Wainwright with us. He is a former councillor in the city of Fremantle, and also is one of the national co-conveners of Socialist Alliance, and has also been a regular commentator on US imperialism and international kind of politics. He just recently produced an article for Green Left responding to this ongoing Russian-Ukraine conflict that has dominated the kind of headlines. And in fact, often the media response to that often gives, I guess, a very one-sided kind of view of the conflict. And of course, this is why we have Sam in our program today, to have a bit of an alternative narrative on what is actually going on. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning to you.
Okay, so maybe to kind of start off, you argue in your article that the relentless drive by the United States to expand NATO up to Russia's border and encircle its military is at the centre of the Ukraine crisis. And I guess, what do you kind of mean by that? And I guess, kind of unpack that kind of argument a bit more.
Sure. Look, I think, you know, at the outset, let's say that there's plenty of things not to like about Vladimir Putin and his politics in Russia. Having said that, though, some of the security concerns that Russia has raised, I think, are quite reasonable. You know, NATO was supposedly formed to confront the Soviet bloc. Well, with the dissolution of the Soviet bloc and the Warsaw Pact back in 1991, NATO should have been dissolved then as well. And the fact that NATO wasn't dissolved, and the fact that NATO continues to push eastward, pushing up hard against all Russia's borders, shows very clearly that NATO's function, or one of its key functions, I should say, is basically to encircle Russia militarily. And you shouldn't just think of NATO as just being some benign, nice thing. I mean, it's been responsible for some terrible interventions in former Yugoslavia and Afghanistan. And also, NATO reserves the right for itself to install nuclear missiles on Russia's borders. Now, I'd say to people, just imagine if you can, the US reaction if Russia was seeking to install nuclear missiles on the US southern border. I mean, the United States just wouldn't tolerate it. They would have invaded Mexico long time ago. And I think, you know, the Russian people, don't worry about Vladimir Putin and his particular, you know, his sort of game playing and his politics. The Russian people actually have a right to be free of that sort of menace as well. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we endorse all the responses, all the ways in which Putin tries to push back, but there can be no question that it's a really aggressive drive by the United States via NATO to encircle Russia, and in our region to encircle China, that is actually what is driving a new Cold War in our times.
And you mentioned the United States, and I guess it's quite important, I guess, what are, I guess, your comments about how the Biden administration in the United States, and I guess equally the liberal media, has attempted to kind of inflame the conflict for their own political interests. And in fact, there's one element with the Biden administration kind of pushing on this sort of narrative against, in that a sense that it's almost a way of sort of distracting from, you know, their own sort of domestic failures in the country to serve the interests of ordinary people within the United States.
Yeah, well, it's been a curious thing. We've had this shrill insistence by the Biden administration, and just breathlessly repeated without critique by most Western media, that an all-out invasion and occupation of Ukraine by Russia is imminent. It's just about to happen. It was going to happen tomorrow. That's been like that for nearly 3 weeks now. Now, in spite of the fact that both Russia and Ukraine itself have said that this isn't about to happen, so there's been relatively little analysis of why this strange disjuncture in our media. And one thing that it suggests to me is that the United States is very keen to create a pretext for pushing along its geostrategic imperatives in Europe, and so that they include pushing more NATO troops up against the borders with Ukraine, trying to stymie the Nord Stream 2 gas project and blocking the expansion of Russian gas sales to the United States, The United States doesn't want Russia to get that revenue in the first instance, but in the second, would also like a market for its own fracked gas. It seems like Biden is looking for an excuse for more sanctions on Russia as well. And it's almost like the United States has been, while knowing that a full-scale invasion and occupation of Ukraine by Russia is probably, and look, I desperately hope I'm not proven wrong, but it's probably the least likely option. Nonetheless, they have been poking and pushing and trying to encourage some kind of conflict. It's pretty clear that the United States is the one that really wants a conflict out of this. And if we're going to see one, it'll most likely be in the Donbass. As you say, I think there is also an element of the United States, firstly trying to recover, the United States and NATO trying to recover some of their prestige given the disaster in Afghanistan. And as you say, it's par for the course that when a US administration is starting to flag in popularity, it seeks to distract attention by appearing tough and decisive abroad. So I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things in the mix there. And it's hard to know exactly, you know, in which proportions they have contributed to this situation, but I think they're all part of it. And I think we should also just to go back a step. I mean, one of the reasons I think that a full-scale invasion and occupation of Ukraine by Russia is not so likely is that it would just be massively costly to Russia. The cost of the Russian economy would just be absolutely enormous. And I don't think it would fit Putin's strategic scheming. While I think Russia is right to be aggrieved by NATO expansion, I mean, Putin's, you know, responses can be quite cynical and manipulative, and he's quite prepared to interfere in the affairs of neighbouring countries. But a occupation would just be too costly for Russia, I think. I don't think that's the more likely thing. As I said, attempt really to restart the conflict in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass, by the United States. I mean, the US and its NATO allies have just been absolutely pumping Ukraine with weaponry. And one thing that's often not mentioned in the Western media is that the Ukrainian government forces have massed around 120,000 troops along the line of contact, which is actually in breach of the Minsk agreements, which is supposed to govern a peaceful resolution of the conflict in the Donbass. So I think if there is going to be an outbreak of war, that's where it'll be. And frankly, that would be disastrous. Whether it started because, you know, Russia tries to nibble away at a bit more Ukrainian territory, or because Ukraine tries to retake the Donbass by force, egged on by the US. In both situations, it would be a terrible outcome for human life and destruction, and for, you know, chances for creating a better world in that part of Europe.
Yeah. And I guess that gets into, the next question, although you've sort of answered some aspects of this question, in your kind of early responses, but I think I'll just sort of frame it around, ask it anyway, because I think, you know, there's other sort of dynamics, I think, that you haven't necessarily covered. Because I guess one of the kind of common things has been that even in Australia, they're kind of painting this kind of picture that, you know, conflict between Ukraine and Russia is inevitable. Almost like, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. Russia is like this big sort of evil kind of empire that's just, you know, wanting to kind of expand. And I guess I want to hear your comments on why do you think that, you know, why is it that we should reject this narrative that conflict is inevitable? But also I want to see your answer to, you know, the fact that the media has actually been putting a very kind of one-sided kind of view on this conflict, like in an actual fact, you know, the relative kind of power of Russia compared to the rest of the world is actually, you know, basically Russia is actually quite, as you argue in your article, is actually quite a much weaker power than, say, Western powers. And I guess want to hear your kind of comments on that, especially in terms of the dynamics of how we understand, or how socialists understand, imperialism.
Yeah, sure. Look, just before I get onto that, one thing I do want to say is that even though I think it's important to stress, is even though I think a full-scale occupation, you know, invasion and occupation of Ukraine by Russia is highly unlikely, of course it is still possible. And even though I think NATO's posture has been fundamentally aggressive to Russia, that wouldn't justify such a response by Russia. I mean, it should go without saying that Ukrainian people have a right to decide their own future. Yeah, look, there's sort of the way our media presents Russia, it's, I mean, it's, first it's as if, you know, Putin is just a monster who does bad things because he's bad. And it's almost like he can't be rationalized with. Now, you know, Putin's politics is pretty ghastly. You know, it rests on sort of hyper-Russian nationalism, very sort of conservative social moral order, nostalgia for, you know, the strong centralized state of the Soviet Union, while rejection of any idea of socialism. So it's this. There's not much to recommend Putin's kind of worldview. But I should add as well that things are pretty grim in Ukraine as well. I mean, the Western media almost tries to present Ukraine like it's some glorious liberal democracy. You know, we can have another debate about just how democratic and glorious our liberal democracies are. But the fact is that democratic space is also being squeezed quite brutally in Ukraine. And it's interesting, you know, it's a very hostile posture that the West takes to both China and Russia, trying to encircle them militarily and encircle them with sanctions and all the rest of it, that actually helps feed sort of hyper-nationalist authoritarian politics in both countries and tends to justify it. And we should remember that both Russia and China have actually suffered, you know, horrendously in the Second World War in a way that most Australians can't imagine through terrible occupation. Yes, look, back to Russia's sort of strength and power. Look, you know, Russia in some sense is a bit like a light from a dead star. You know, it's inherited a lot of the cutting-edge military technology from the Soviet Union, and there's a few areas where it has, you know, where it's a world leader in some areas of military technology and avionics and that sort of stuff. But overall, Russia is a relatively poor country, you know, so the productivity of labour in Russia, that is, you know, the value of goods and services produced in 1 hour of human work is probably only about a quarter of what it is in the really rich, developed, high-tech countries of North America, Japan, Western Europe and Australia. So in that sense, you know, Russia's economy, in terms of its overall level of development, is more like Brazil or Mexico or Turkey. And that's one of the reasons why it would be very difficult for Russia to sustain a long-term, you know, full-on occupation of Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine might be just next door, but that would still be a difficult thing. We need to bear in mind it's only the United States has the military power to project a full-on invasion and occupation across the other side of the globe, like it did in Iraq. So one thing about, you know, Russia's sort of military actions is that in its efforts to try and break out of its own, the sort of encirclement being imposed on it by the West, and also in an effort to draw, you know, its nearest neighbours into its own, you know, economic and strategic projects, it is prepared to interfere in the affairs of neighbouring countries, and sometimes in a really destructive and unhelpful way. So even though I think in the world, you know, in the world setting at the moment, the primary aggressor is the US and the US military alliances. First and foremost, they are the threat to world peace. Having said that, though, the responses of Russia and China can sometimes be, you know, very destructive and unhelpful. And so it doesn't mean that we should automatically, flip over and support them. As I say in the article, that would be the anti-imperialism of fools. Instead, we need to sort of step back and really try to understand what is going on. And have a sense of what would best advance peace both there and in our part of the world as well.
Yeah, and I guess awesome. The next kind of question is, I guess why it's important to kind of reject NATO expansionism, the actions of the Russian state, I guess, in regards to Ukraine haven't been necessarily kind of pure either. And I guess I want to hear some of your, even though you've made some comments earlier alluding to effect, I guess I want to hear some of your comments, I guess, on some of the dynamics around Russia and its relationship to Ukraine. And I guess, why is it important to, I guess, support self-determination for Ukraine?
Yeah, look, it's perhaps a good place to start would be the so-called Euromaidan movement, which overthrew President Viktor Yanukovych. And the Western media sometimes describes him as being pro-Russian, which is not quite accurate. the essentially Yanukovych represented a faction of oligarchs in Ukraine, and was in fact about to sign a financial loan deal with Europe, but sensing that that would see Ukraine drift out of Russia's sort of sphere of influence, sort of economic and political sphere of influence, and closer to Europe, Putin actually trumped that deal and offered Ukraine a better deal, which Yanukovych signed up to. Now, that prompted a strong reaction in west of Ukraine, and as many of you would know, there was a movement known as the Euromaidan, which essentially overthrew by force Viktor Yanukovych. And while that movement to overthrow President Yanukovych was heavily influenced by the United States, the United States was definitely involved at a very high level. And the street fighters pushing at the front of that movement were extreme Ukrainian far-right nationalists. Nonetheless, there was a certain mass base of support for that. You know, amongst Ukrainians, especially in the west of Ukraine, where Ukrainian national consciousness is stronger and people are more likely to both speak Ukrainian in their vast majority and identify ethnically as Ukrainian, there's certainly a stronger, I guess you could say, kind of a liberal kind of hope that Ukraine could become part of sort of a prosperous, democratic Western Europe, and maybe even be drawn into NATO. And so, you know, there's a bunch of different strands, both Ukrainian national consciousness and this hope for being part of the European Union, helped fuel the Euromaidan movement. But equally, the anti-Maidan movement in the east and south of the country had a mass base as well. So it's important to remember that Ukraine does have long historic, cultural, and linguistic links with Russia as well, with people married across families and all that kind of thing. And of course, there are people, you know, in parts of eastern and southern Ukraine, Russian is the majority language. And I mean, there are both people who identify ethnically as Russian, who speak Russian, and also those who identify ethnically as Ukrainian but speak Russian as well. So it's just to give you a bit of a sense of some of the complexity of the thing. And one of the first things that the new sort of Ukrainian nationalist government did that overthrew Yanukovych was to remove Russian as one of the co-official languages. Now, they then sort of subsequently tried to reverse some of that, but that really heightened fears amongst Russian speakers and essentially created what became something of a civil war situation and produced the small breakaway self-declared republics that occupy part of the Donbass in eastern Ukraine now. So, you know, all that makes it very clear that there's not going to be a military solution to the situation in the Donbass. One thing I forgot to mention too is one of the other reasons that there was resistance to the Euromaidan in the east of Ukraine is, you know, it can't just be reduced to cultural linguistic things, but there's also an economic dimension to it as well. And that is that the, you know, Western Ukraine tends to be a lot more agricultural, with the exception of Kiev, which is much more kind of centered on the sort of service industry and you know, tech firms and all that sort of stuff. Whereas Eastern Ukraine has much more heavy industry, and its economy is traditionally much more integrated with the Russian economy. So it stood to lose out economically if there was greater integration between Ukraine and Europe, which it essentially would have exposed, you know, Ukrainian industrial production to competition from powers like Germany. So all those kinds of things that were at play, and of course, to complicate the process, both sides in that civil conflict in Ukraine were led or significantly influenced by capitalist oligarchs, basically, who were most concerned about their own position and not the well-being of Ukrainian people. So it's quite a mess, but one thing is for certain is that it's not going to be solved militarily, either by Russia or by NATO. I'm trying to egg Ukraine, Ukrainian government on to retake the Donbass regions by force. There's simply got to be a political solution, and that's my real fear is that the US has made it pretty clear that it's not interested in seeing a negotiated solution in the Donbass. And also the Ukrainian government itself, you know, it's some people, you know, you can make a mistake in two directions. So some people sort of flip flip over and then accuse the Ukrainian government of just being far-right nationalists or just neo-Nazis. That's an exaggeration. I mean, there is a pretty repressive atmosphere in Ukraine at the moment, and there's a disproportionate influence of these far-right nationalist and neo-Nazi types in Ukraine, but that doesn't represent majority opinion in Ukraine. But those elements, make it very hard for the Ukrainian government to come to a compromise as well. You know, they would basically, scream traitor if the Ukrainian government tried to negotiate a compromise with the separatist areas in the east, and the United States basically hasn't been helping the situation.
And I guess let's bring it back to the kind of general kind of points. One of your important arguments that you make in your article is that the primary obligation of those serious about peace must be to reject the US-led campaign of encirclement and confrontation. And I guess what can you say about that? And I guess what is some of the solutions, as a socialist, that your guest that socialists should be putting forward in terms of how we should be resolving this conflict?
Yeah, well, look, as people living in a wealthy, developed first world country, we need to pinch ourselves every now and then and remind ourselves that the world is sharply divided into wealthy countries and poor countries. And we live we're some of the lucky ones amongst the 15% that live in the wealthy developed countries. But we need to understand that separation of the world into rich and poor between the so-called global north and the global south is not an accident. They're codependent categories. And that there is a massive transfer of wealth from the global south towards the global north. That continues every day and is actually worse in our current, so-called neo-colonial or post-colonial era than it was during the period of colonialism, that it's actually a violent world order. For that division of the world to be sustained requires violence. And it is sustained with violence. And any country that tries to buck that global order faces the wrath of the United States primarily. Let's not forget that we were part of an intervention in Iraq, an illegal, full-scale invasion and occupation of Iraq that cost the lives of 1 million, perhaps as many as 2 million people, depending on how you make the calculations. An intervention that absolutely ruptured Iraqi society, shattered it, and created the material basis, the economic and cultural basis for the emergence of a ghastly gangster outfit like ISIS. So we shouldn't for one moment imagine that the US war alliance is a force for good and peace in the world. It's a force for violence in the world. It is the primary source of violence and terrorism in the world. There's no possibility of creating a better world, let alone confronting the serious challenge of runaway global warming while we remain locked into propping up this violent world order. So for us in a country like Australia, there's only so much we can do about Ukraine and Russia. But what we can control, or we should be seeking to exert an influence on, is the policies of our own government. And at the moment, our own government is absolutely, you've heard the stuff by Peter Dutton, who seems to be absolutely gagging for a war with China. We need to break that military alliance with the United States. There's no path to peace as long as we're locked into AUKUS.
Thank you very much, Sam, for doing this interview. I think this has been a very insightful kind of discussion. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.